Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 28 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and on this episode, we are going to deviate from our normal way of doing things and talk to somebody who's not currently vying for an award, but rather someone who's already won just about every award that's out there. Why? Because when you get a chance to talk to William Shatner, you take it. He's a living legend, best known for the role of Captain Kirk on Star Trek. And this year marks the 50th anniversary of the airing of the first episode of that classic franchise. So I thought now would be as great a time as ever to sit down with the 84-year-old and find out how he's marking the occasion, and also to look back at an entire career that's often underappreciated. This is a guy who began as a Shakespearean-trained actor, who was a prolific performer during the days of live television, whose career then took a major turn with Star Trek and then took a major turn in the other direction when the show was canceled, who then acquired a cult following when it was brought back in syndication, and who, in the years since, has had one of the most varied, colorful, and prolific careers imaginable. We talked to him about all of that, as well as the recent J.J. Abrams versions of Star Trek and Star Wars, and Justin Lin's upcoming take on the Star Trek franchise. I met with Shatner at his offices in Studio City, and I hope you enjoy the conversation that we had as much as I did. First of all, thank you so much for doing this, and tell me...
Have you in my ken.
Yeah, right? I was going to ask if you could just set the scene. Where are we?
We're floating through space. We're approaching the moon in a tiny vessel. We're broadcasting back to Earth on these microphones. You're in your spacesuit. Your head is swollen, but that's the helmet.
Well, anywhere space travel with you is a unique privilege. So
Right. It
must be hard for you to believe this is the 50th anniversary of Star Trek.
So give me a comparable experience, even in less years, of something. Like, have you got children?
No.
You haven't got children?
No.
What's the matter?
Well, you recommend it?
No. But you can mark the passage of time. You look at your child, and they emerge from the womb. You think, oh, gosh, that's the miracle of that. And the next thing you know, they're going to a very expensive college. And in that space of time.
Right.
The time is warped. You've heard about that.
Of course.
And that's what the... That's what this is. It really isn't the 50th anniversary. It just got canceled, Star Trek, but we're in a time warp.
Right. Well, how are you marking the occasion here? I mean, there's a few festivities that are going on.
I wish I could leap into the air, but I can't because it's 50 years later.
Well, but let's talk about a few of the things that I'm aware of. I'm sure there are many I'm not. But to begin with, the music of Star Trek is still being talked about and played and so important to the whole franchise. How is that being celebrated?
Well, there is this new venture called The Ultimate Voyage, which is going to play, I think, in 100 places in the United States. I hesitate to even say cities or towns because they're going to smaller venues as well. Anywhere you are in the United States, The Ultimate Voyage will be within your reach. And it is an extraordinary experience of seeing different scenes of Star Trek and scenes that are linked from one Star Trek to another, for example, where there might be a mutual theme like man and machine. And that was dramatized in the Star Trek I was in and then Star Trek III and Star Trek V. They're brought together to show you how different writers varied their drama on that theme. In addition to that, the music that accompanied those scenes is being played by a live orchestra.
Wow.
So there is a conductor conducting what sometimes is magnificent music written by great composers like Goldsmith, Jerry Goldsmith. It's being conducted live on stage. You're seeing the visuals on a 40-foot screen. And not only is the scene and the theme entrancing, so the conflict of ideas and how Star Trek handled those ideas, but you're seeing movie music being added to the scene, and you're seeing it happening. So whereas you might be unconscious of the music that's enhancing the scene, and people who aren't in show business making movies are invariably unaware of the music. They're so involved in the scene.
Right.
But that is also applies to the professionals. Many times, professionals who are working in movies can't remember the music because the music is so much a part of the scene.
Yeah.
But here your attention is brought to the conductor who's conducting the music. Mm-hmm. So you become aware of how that music enhances and enables and supports the scene that's going on. It's an extraordinary experience.
It sounds amazing.
That's the ultimate voyage.
Yeah.
At a place near you.
And all the way through May 8th, I see. So that's
exactly.
Terrific.
Starting in the next week and going to May.
Yeah. And let me also ask you another thing that's being done to commemorate the occasion, I believe, is a book that you've written, right?
So I knew Leonard Nimoy, to give his name the right pronunciation, when we met on Star Trek, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that was 50 years ago. And Leonard passed this past year. And he was a dear friend of mine. A deep feeling I had for him. Mm-hmm. And I thought how rare it is for men to have that kind of friendship. I never had it before. Mm-hmm. Even as a kid, I didn't know people that well. And I'm referring to the brother that you grow up with, that you upon whom you can lean, or they, with abandonment, can lean on you. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of friendship I'm referring to. I never had that. I had it with Leonard. And now that he's gone, the experiences that we had, which I could have said to him, remember the time we were in, and he would have said, yeah, you were so, and I said, I wasn't. That's gone. Mm-hmm. I can't validate my experiences. And that's a horrible, mm-hmm. meaningful moment.
Well, I can't wait. Does that have a title yet?
Leonard, 50 Years of Friendship with a Remarkable Man.
Terrific.
And it'll be out in 3 or 4 weeks.
Very exciting.
And it's getting great reviews. Sensational reviews. Maybe the best reviews I've ever gotten.
Wow. Well, it's a terrific story. So what I hope we can do is go back a little bit and just discuss how we got to this point where you've had such a terrific career, continuing to do great work in all different formats. And so, but it started out in Montreal, right? And I just wonder what sort of an upbringing you had. What kind of a family were you born into? Was any of this in the cards from the start? Or would it surprise, you know, the childhood?
My mother played Mahjong, so was it in the Mahjong?
Was it in the Mahjong, exactly.
Right.
But I mean, if somebody came to you and said as a kid, you know, William Shatner, you're gonna have this kind of a life, would you have believed it?
As against the extraordinariness of your question, the answer would really be yes. Not this kind of career. Mm-hmm. But I knew from the age of 6 what I wanted to do. And I was. In Montreal, at the age of 6, I was performing in amateur theatrics. As a teenager, I was doing professional radio. Mm-hmm. And I never did anything else but act, write, direct, in some manner, entertain you. And that's been going. I've never driven a cab. I've never waited on a table. I've never received an unemployment check.
Yeah.
I've just gone on to be an actor from the moment I was conscious at about the age of 6 or 7. So if you were to say you were going to be the actor for the rest of your life, I would say, of course. To be talking to you as something of a celebrity because of one or another show, that would have been beyond anything I could imagine.
So what put you on that path? I understand you may be born with a certain type of personality that's going to work with acting, you know, that may drew you to it. But what actually started you acting?
Well, this I refer to in this one-man show that I'm doing, that I'm on tour with in the Northeast, the Southeast, and the Northwest in the next 3 weeks. I was in a camp play, and the play was about, it was written by the campers and all, and it was something about the Nazis going to take me away. And I made the audience cry as I talked to my dog about not wanting to go. And when I looked up and the curtain calls were there, I made people cry. Mm-hmm. Later, my dad picked me up, and it's my boy Bill. Mm-hmm. And I got love and I got applause, mm-hmm. and my course was set. As I say in the show, a star is born.
Yeah. And somewhat related to what we're talking about here, you were born quite religious as a Jewish person.
Well,
right?
Yes. I suppose you could say so. Mm-hmm. I followed the path that my my father and my uncles were doing. But got out of that as quickly as possible. And I find myself more spiritual than religious.
Interesting. So off you go eventually to McGill. Was that because you felt that it was important to have a college education rather than go right into acting? Or was it because your parents or somebody was saying you better do this to cover
sure.
your bases?
I didn't have the independence that I see children have. No, Daddy, I'm not going to do that. In my day, what do you mean you're not going to do that? Quack! Okay, I'm going to do that.
Right.
So it didn't occur to me not to follow especially my father's wishes. And it just seemed a natural course of events to go to high school and go on to college, and then to choose business at college and go into business. And he was in a small business, and he expected me to go with him. And I guess that was my destiny, except deep within this other side of me was the desire to be an actor, although the reality of being an actor and making money, and I remember that even the sum of money, if I could make $100 a week, I would be very happy.
So how is it that you graduate from McGill, you have your business degree?
Right.
How do you get back on the acting track?
Well, I'd been acting in Montreal for all those years.
Even while in college?
While in college. Yeah. I was doing the college musicals, doing the college radio, doing the college theater, writing, directing, acting, and then doing it as an amateur outside of college in Montreal. So I was performing all the time, continuously, all my life, in one place or another. So when I graduated, I took my stand and I said, I got to try it. And I was immediately successfully employed, not at a great deal of money, no money at all, but I was employed by professional summer theater, and then went on to winter theater in Canada, and then went on to Stratford.
And eventually New York. Was there a job that brought you to New York, or was it the hope for a job that brought you to New York?
I was lucky enough to be able to join the Stratford Shakespeare Company in Stratford, Ontario. And I did 3 years of Stratford. And in the last year, we did, as a part of the Stratford Festival's entertainment, Marlowe's Tamburlaine. And Tyrone Guthrie, whose name then was the great English director, he started one of his accomplishments is the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So Tyrone Guthrie directed this extraordinary version of Marlowe's Tamburlaine, and we brought it to New York for a limited run. And I had a decent part in it, and I was recognized, and agents came after me. And long story short is I stayed in New York, and my career began.
I wonder if you can clear up something that may be true, maybe not be true. I've tried to read a lot of articles and profiles and things from over the years, and one of the things that I've heard was that the kind of unique Shatner style of speaking that people associate sometimes with you, with the varying speeds and the pauses and things, which I know you yourself have, you know, mocked on many occasions or sent up in one way or another. Did that start while you were doing the Broadway production of The World of Susie Wong? Was that part of that?
The story I tell.
Yeah.
See, this manner of speaking, the so-called manner of speaking.
Right.
Like, I used to ask the question, does Jimmy Stewart know that you're imitating Jimmy Stewart when he was alive?
Right.
Jimmy Stewart.
Right.
So I mock my tongue-in-cheek myself about having to stop people from standing up and leaving this terrible play. This play was a disaster for the first 3 months, and I had to keep pushing the pace of the play to try and keep people from walking out, and finally it changed character from a drama to a comedy, and people started staying, and instead of closing, we ran for 2 years. So I send myself up by saying, I had to say, sit down, and I'm going to, and in order to compel the people,
right.
Like, what is he doing? He's insane. I better sit in my seat before he attacks me.
Right.
So I set myself up. This manner of speaking on Star Trek, and I see it sometimes in Star Trek, was only, what the hell is the next line?
And that's truly the... I'm
going out the door, and I'm asking you to stay.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So one of the things, I guess, that was happening a lot in New York while you were there doing some, starting with the theater, was wasn't a lot of television shot out of New York. And is that how you ended up on...
That was the center.
Right.
Not only was it, is it, was it then the center of theater,
right,
which it is, of course, still, sure, Broadway, but it was the center of all television. All the networks had studios that broadcast live television. And I was came in on the latter day of live television. I was quite popular as a live television actor in the latter days of live television.
And worked with a lot of the greats. I mean, the first time I think that, well, first of all, you were doing Playhouse 90 and all these great ones. And mm-hmm. worked, I think Frankenheimer was one of the great TV directors.
I worked with him.
Right.
I worked with all those guys in the last stages of their television career prior to them becoming big guys in films.
In film.
Never worked with them in big films.
They forgot about you.
Yeah, right? Right.
So wasn't it the first time you dealt with Rod Serling? Because, you know, everybody loves the Zone episode you did. But the first time was actually Playhouse 90.
Exactly. And we all became sort of a company.
Right. So what was it between the Playhouse 90 experience and then these two great episodes that you did with the guy on the wing and then also getting his fortune read? What made the Rod Serling experience special, if anything? Maybe it wasn't.
Well, it wasn't. It was just another job,
right,
which, you know, these scripts. So you ask yourself the question, I don't know how many. Do you know how many shows Twilight Zone did?
I don't know.
It's got to be 100, right?
Or
more,
at least. Yeah.
Hundreds, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot. They did a lot of shows. Why do the two shows I did, the one on the wing and the one and the guy in the town getting a fortune, why are they the amongst, if not the most popular shows? If you were taking the top 13 and you were going to do a marathon, you'd always find those two in the... Why? What is it?
Do you have a theory?
I have a theory. But
yeah.
Have you got a theory?
Well, part of it is people love seeing you before Star Trek.
I love that.
Right?
That's my theory.
Yeah?
No. I'm glad that's your theory.
Yeah.
No, my theory is that, like Star Trek, there are subterranean themes that are hit by the writer that may or may not know that that's a deep-seated thing. So fear of flying is a really... I mean, I, who've flown propeller planes, I'm a pilot, I'm a pilot of helicopters, mm-hmm. I'm taking helicopter lessons, I'm an aerobatic, I've checked myself out in aerobatics. I mean, I'm a pilot.
Yeah.
I know flight. I understand the theory of flight. I get into turbulence and the thing. I'm like, oh, geez. Okay? There's a little concern in my mind about flying.
Yeah.
It's always lurking there. If God meant us to fly, you know. So the thought that there's a little Czechoslovakian acrobat in a furry suit
on your wing,
on my wing at 500 miles an hour.
Right.
You know, there's something universal, so deep. How about getting caught in a town where, well, it's the stock market. The stock market is down. Oh, Jesus, man. Are you going to sell? The stock market's down. Are you going to sell? No, don't sell, because it's going to go back up.
Right.
I'm telling you, it's going to go back up.
Yeah.
We know it's cyclical, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you worried? Because this little message is coming to you. The stock market's down.
Right.
Don't sell. It'll go up. Maybe you should sell because it's going to go down further.
Well, those are...
And those are the universals.
Yeah. And I guess that pervades the series. I mean,
But, you know, there are two human emotions that those two shows...
Yeah.
In their fantasy,
right,
science fiction, appeal to.
Fantastic.
And at its best, that's what Star Trek did.
With film, when you started making movies, why do you think, I mean, it sounds like that was more of a frustrating, less instantly clicking kind of an experience than TV. Why did you kind of resonate less in movies than in TV, do you think?
I don't know. I didn't feel that way. The early movies I made were really good.
Sure.
I was with a lot of good people, and then I left it for the stage, come to think of it. No, I acting, whatever you do, is always, there's always, it's always the same. Mm-hmm. Whether you put a mustache on and acquire an accent, or it's you and your sensibilities. And whatever the medium, you take the energy down for, if the camera's 6 inches from your nose, and you bring the energy up if it's a large house, so you got to fill the house. But it all stems from the truth of your being in reading those words. There's no difference other than what I've mentioned.
Interesting.
So whether it's a movie, TV, or a theater, it's an enviable job.
What was going on in your life when you first heard the words Star Trek, and did it seem like anything out of the ordinary to you, or was it just another project?
Well, they had made a pilot of Star Trek, NBC and Roddenberry, and then it didn't sell, but there was an unusual, if not unique, moment that NBC said to Roddenberry, but we'd like to try again with a different cast. Roddenberry had seen me on TV, I think. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he called me and said, would I entertain the idea of playing the captain? Come see the original pilot made with Jeffrey Hunter. And Leonard Nimoy was there as Spock, but a totally different, he was playing it quite differently. So I went to see it. I thought it was terrific. I thought it was a little heavy-handed, mm-hmm. A little ponderous, a little taking yourself too seriously. And I suggested, made those very suggestions. And the second script was less ponderous. I played it less heavily. And Leonard had grasped the character at that point. He had zoomed onto how to play Spock. And so everything congealed. Everything came together on that second violin.
How quickly did it become clear to you that it was going to be an unusually special, popular kind of a production? I mean,
it never occurred to me, and it didn't occur to anybody else.
Because it wasn't for a
because
while.
Because it wasn't. We were in the top 40 shows. So you're in, like, you know, so you could just hear some executive saying, you know, we could get more advertising money if we got a better show, a more popular show than the one that's 35th. What's it called? Star Trek. You could just hear their
right.
their voices. It's not in the top 20, although I had a show in the top 20 yeah. canceled. But, you know, 20 to 40, you're in an area where it's dicey.
And you felt that pressure while you guys were aware of that while you were working on
every,
the show.
Every one of those years.
Wow.
And in fact, there's a somewhat well known, at least among the knowledgeable, that there was a campaign to change the executives' minds. I don't think that ever happened, but I'm told that it might have. A lot of letters were sent to executives: don't cancel Star Trek. They may not have been ready to cancel, or they were on the edge and they didn't. I'm not sure.
Were you really enjoying the experience of doing it? Was it something that you kind of dreaded, the idea that it might be canceled?
No,
or was
no.
it?
That was a well-written part.
Yeah,
I got to do a lot of things, a lot of wonderful things as an actor. That was a terrific 3 years of for an actor.
And as far as the experience of just who you were working with there across the board, I mean, was it a happy sort of set? Were people, everybody buddies, or what, you know, how did it?
Well, when you say was everybody buddies, essentially, yes. There were three leads in the show, and the three of us got along mm-hmm. extremely well. I've delineated for dramatic purposes some of the misunderstandings, mm-hmm. Which were brief and small, and you know, like any family would have a disagreement. There were an occasional, but nothing untoward. And for 3 years. It was terrific. I had a great time. I never felt badly. I was unaware of anybody else feeling badly at the time.
When did you find out it was over? How did you find out it was over?
I didn't get a paycheck once.
Really?
I don't know. Where is that pay? What?
Right.
You mean there's no paycheck? No, it was somebody, I think, somebody came down and said, forget it.
Was the impact of the show during those initial years before it kind of was revived, did it change your experience in the real world already? Were people getting fanatic about...
Well, not I don't remember fanatic, but yeah. People certainly recognized, oh, look, there goes...
Markedly more than before.
Markedly more than before. But I had been in a series prior to that that went 13 weeks against a very popular show. So it wasn't very well seen. It wasn't popular, mm-hmm. but still people were beginning to recognize me as Shatner.
Yeah.
Live television, theater, movies. You know, I was doing quite well prior to Star Trek.
As it started to get increasingly big for you, was it something that you were comfortable with? I mean, losing your anonymity can't be totally enjoyable, even if you're well paid and doing things you like and whatever. How did you handle that transition?
I don't remember it being a transition. You know, I was popular in Canada. I'd been on radio, television, even movies and stage and in the big cities, Montreal, Toronto. When I came to the States and I got immediately a lot of live television, my face was known and I was doing movies. So people began to look at me and point out, I never have been without somebody saying, oh, I think that's, you know, at the beginning it was the, how do I know you?
Right.
But there was always something made me lower my eyes and pull my cap down.
Right. And you don't mind having, you know.
Well, I mind, but I don't even think about it.
Right.
I have tinnitus, which is the ringing in the ears.
Sure.
So the only way tinnitus goes away, which it doesn't, is habituation. You don't hear it anymore because you're so used to it. Like, I'm talking to you, and I hear it now because I'm talking to you about
right.
it. But had I not brought the subject up,
right.
I wouldn't be hearing it. The question when I first got it many years ago was, what degree does tinnitus play in your life? I'd put 90%, 95%. I can't do anything. Now it's zero. It's 1%. I don't hear it.
Yeah.
So the same thing applies to being looked at. I don't even... think about it. I pull my cap down. I avoid eye contact, which leads me to think that they're not looking at me. If I'm not looking at them, they're not looking at me. And I just saunter on or run or hide behind an umbrella or something.
So, but anyone who, you know, I think maybe some of the stuff years later when you did the SNL appearance about Get a Life or whatever, and I can totally get where that would be coming from. I think anyone that has any degree of empathy can get that.
Well, that was a tongue-in-cheek, and
that's
what it was, hopefully a laugh.
Yeah.
And most of the people who, aficionados of Star Trek, laughed at it. And those that didn't, soon afterwards did.
Yeah. So it's not, but just to completely set the record straight, it's not like the sort of a resentment of the people that are obsessed with
this.
On
the contrary, I'm totally grateful.
Yeah.
Have always been grateful.
Right.
Wrote a book called Get a Life.
Right.
Which I figured out that they were coming to see each other. After my due diligence on the book, they were coming to see each other. Then I did a film documentary, which I also called Get a Life. And there I learned that it's not coming to see, but it's part of a mythological thing.
You're talking about like conventions and all of the things that they do to celebrate.
Everything about Star Trek.
Yeah.
The popularity of science fiction is almost ritualistic because it seeks to answer some of those unanswerable questions. What's out there? Is that a UFO? If it is, what's inside it? Is it a little green man? And how will they greet us? And what are they thinking? And since we can't imagine what we don't know, what about the people who know what we don't know?
And those questions always just on a personal level fascinated you as well?
Absolutely. It fascinates me. And it's like playing around with what's it going to be like when you die? You know, I'm old and I don't feel old. I mean, it's like 50 years have gone by and I still think I'm 30 and my legs don't quite work the way they used to, but that'll go away soon. Sort of thing, you know?
Right.
But you start thinking about death more and it's fearful. And at the same time, you wonder what's going to happen. And that thought about death and the mystery of death and is there life after it? And does your spirit go on? Do you suddenly know the answers to all these extraordinary questions, or do you die unknowing of the milieu in which you are born, the universe? Will you get to know, will you understand the universe? Will you, even if you just say, oh, that's what dark matter is. That's what dark energy is. No, I don't know.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So,
and that's science fiction.
Yeah. And obviously continues to hold a great appeal. You look at everything from this year, The Martian, and all the things that it just never stops.
It's tantalizing the human imagination beyond belief.
So in those years immediately after Star Trek's cancellation, initial period there, I guess 69 was when it stopped, it sounds like it was a frustrating time for you, right? I mean, personally, professionally, just in every sense. I know you'd lost your father. I think you're marriage was over at that point. Now it's, you got to just pay the bills. It affected your living situation. As you look back at that time, what stands out to you? Were you kind of down on things?
My desperation really? to make a living, to keep my children alive, to pay the alimony, and to have some, be able to eat sushi now and then.
And so what was the solution? I mean, it was not...
Well, the solution that year, the solution was summer stock. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. I lived in the back of my truck because I didn't want to pay the money for hotels. And I did 13 weeks of summer stock and came back and, you know, did whatever I could do as the tempo rebuilt.
And do you feel that part of the issue was that people could no longer imagine you as something other than this type of
guy? I didn't know
how
to analyze it.
Yeah.
You know, they talk about the fact that it takes a while, years sometimes, for somebody who's popular on in a television series to come back in another television series. At least that was the conceit then. It might be true. But I was on to other things. I've forgotten what it was now, but... You know, I never went any lengthy period of time without being gainfully employed.
Right.
And by that I mean sometimes weeks or months. Hardly a month. I mean, I don't remember. I remember playing with jobs all the time.
Right. And it seems that you got creative as well. I mean, that's when the LP, for instance, happened, or other things that were outside the box, right?
Right. I was doing everything I could to sell entertainment, whether I was writing it, directing it, or acting in it.
Interesting. So was the coming out of that, the return of Star Trek, in a sense, because of syndication, that is what brought you back to popularity?
Yes, I believe that was the case. When it went into syndication, more people saw it. It was at a better time slot, and away we went.
And was there any pause on your end about revisiting this project when people are saying, hey, you know what, I think one of the things was that Star Wars, right, had just been a big hit.
That was the impetus to the movies, that's for sure. Star Wars took off and Paramount needed a Star Wars, and hey, we got this project, and then they began to fiddle with it as to whether it would be a series, movie of the week, and then it became a film.
And all of a sudden, it seems like then it blew up to a different... I mean, I don't know if you... I saw a few documentaries in your pile here. I wonder if you're familiar with the documentary Searching for Sugar Man. Have you heard that one? It won the Oscar.
I got a pile of documentaries that I've got to look at.
Yeah, well, one of these is about a guy who didn't even realize how his popularity was growing when he was a singer, who some bootleg copies of his music were in South Africa, oddly enough. And years later, he found out. He's a carpenter, so years later, he finds out he's huge in South Africa.
That's hysterical.
And it just, in a way, feels somewhat like what you experienced, because all of a sudden, out of the woodwork, and maybe these were newer fans or whatever, but you have this...
It was out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
It was. It came as news to me.
Yeah. And as you look back at those Star Trek movies that you did, was the first versus the second, you know, any of that, do you have any feelings? I know a lot of people feel that the second is probably more, it's more quoted and more revisited maybe, right? Did you have a feeling about one versus the other?
Well, I was being so much a part of it. I knew that one was Logie because of the time. It was premiered and you know, you hear the story, you hear the quote, the print was wet when we played. The print was wet. It was opening in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And And somebody was getting off an airplane at 5 o'clock in the evening with a print under their arm to play in the theater that night at 7. It was literally that. So he had no time to really edit. And the special effects just went on without editing. Yeah. It was Star Trek 1 would be a much improved movie if a really fine editor got in there. But nobody cares.
Well, I guess in 1994, I think, was the last time that we saw you really as in the character, right? And obviously met his end, and that was that. Was the end of the character a choice of yours? Was that something you were pushing for?
No. I wrote a book
called
The Return.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to the producer of Star Trek at the time, and I died.
Right.
And that was it.
Right.
And, I died. So here's a book. Called The Return. How I Come Back to Life.
Right. And here's your roadmap for
I've got a roadmap for you. Here's what happens. Here's what Spock does. You read the book. He says, oh, no, we're not going to bring it. We're going to go on to the next generation.
Well, you know, the reason I ask is that when we look at this other franchise that sort of coexisted for a lot of the same time, Star Wars, my understanding, and spoiler alert, turn this off if you haven't seen the latest one, but my understanding was that Harrison Ford wanted out for a long time, and they gave it to him. And this, you know, this is the this. Was,
don't tell me.
No, I'm not saying
I
anything.
No. Well, but Harrison Ford might have wanted out.
Yeah.
But Harrison Ford accepted the job.
He accepted the job. Exactly. So when the new Star Trek,
he needed a new airplane if the one he crashed.
That's very true. When the same person, incidentally, J.J. Abrams, revived Star Trek as a movie, did you want in?
So, I called, J.J. called me and brought me in and talking about a part that I might play, and I said, great. And I took him out for sushi and, you know, and we established a nice acquaintanceship. It never came to pass, and it hasn't come to pass, and I don't know what they would do with me. How would what is that, 20 years later?
But the desire is still there to be able to.
Well, when we were finished our movies, the six movies I made, we were putting Kirk into glasses, graying hair, a little old, you know, hard.
Right.
And I wrote a series of novels about Captain Kirk.
Right.
They allowed me to tell my story of Captain Kirk. So in a series of novels, of Star Trek novels, half a dozen of them, I take him from my own life, of life and death and love and loss. I created this whole world of Star Trek for Captain Kirk. I would have loved to have done them on. They were written.
Yeah.
The Return was written to be a film.
Right.
All those books have a one line. There's no B story.
Right.
It's all the A story of as if you were in a movie and you're following the movie. I'm write these novels as though you're watching a movie. I'm looking at a movie.
Thinking of it cinematically,
I'm thinking of it pictorially, exactly.
So there's another one that's coming shortly, right? Another
edition of Star Trek?
Yeah.
So I've heard. I don't know anything about
but
it.
But okay, so I guess when you look at the fact that these other, and again, coming back to Star Wars for a second, that the three originals were back for this one, does a part of you say, I wish that the same sort of tradition or history was as valued in the Star Trek world, or is it just a different situation?
Well,
because you're not a big Star Wars fan, right?
I am.
You are?
Oh, of course.
So that was just joking on Twitter and stuff.
All of that Twitter stuff is just, it's just having fun.
Yeah, it is funny.
Yeah, it is funny. Is Star Wars better than Star Trek? Who the hell cares? They're both entertaining vehicles, and they're both well done. And J.J. is a master at doing it. So whether he's producing it or directing it, he's got his hand in it, and it's a ride.
Right.
And it's great.
Yeah.
If, of course, the two other characters, the actors are no longer alive, so it leaves me to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And how would they handle it? In science fiction terms, I'm older, I'm heavier, all the problems of age. So what did Captain Kirk do? Die and age? Doesn't sound science fiction-y enough. Or maybe you make him really old. Maybe you go into, I don't know. It seems to have beggared Abrams' imagination.
Right.
So yes, I would love. So as I was saying, we wrote for the aging character,
right.
And that was great fun. I would play an old Captain Kirk, absolutely.
So, but in a
sense, you would have an interesting character,
yeah.
Not a cameo,
right?
Like here I am, aren't I interesting?
Right.
It's the ongoing world,
right?
And it's the imagination in science fiction. Yes, you age in the universe. Time goes on, but time bends
right.
as well. So now, not only is it time bending, your mind has been... I mean, there's so many things you could do
yeah.
using science principles in science fiction.
One of the things that people, I think, really love about you is that, unlike a lot of people who take themselves super seriously, you seem to have a great sense of humor about, you know, kind of laughing about things, including yourself. And one of the great stories I've seen is how the Priceline ads, in which you were essentially... mocking yourself from everything I can gather,
right.
were what inspired this second great television age of your career, right? I mean, it was a correlation.
If you wish to put it in those terms.
Well, is it wrong?
I don't know. I don't see it from there. I mean, what you're seeing is what our points of view are different. Second great age, I don't know. That sounds glacial to me.
No, I just think it's amazing because you hear David E. Kelly or somebody interviewed and they say that it was that ability to kind of have fun with things that made him think of you. And that also, I thought the greatest review that I've ever seen was William Shatner, the man, was playing William Shatner, the character, playing the character Denny Crane, who was playing the character William Shatner. And I mean, but in your own mind, is it that... complex, or was it just...
Well, it's maybe what that guy observed.
Right,
as far as I'm concerned, I'm doing the best I can with my limited resources.
Well, hey, people love both the Practice and Boston Public. But I guess, just to wind down here, we're now celebrating 50 years here. It's a big milestone. Of the folks that are still around from the original collaboration, and how often do you see each other? Are you still, you know, all in touch and friends? And will you be celebrating together?
I'm in touch with DeForest Kelly.
Uh-huh.
I run seances around our dining room table. And he's very well, and he's south. His spirit is in the south. Mm-hmm. He's haunting a southern mansion, but he's very happy. As for Leonard, he hasn't gotten
yeah,
in touch
not back
with
to you yet.
He hasn't gotten
not
back
yet.
To me yet.
No, but I mean, there's a few folks, right? So there's George. There's some others.
I don't see them. To simply put it, I don't see them.
You don't see them.
Well, you might say I never saw them.
You never saw. And last thing is just you know, for folks who
aren't in the know, yeah.
How would you a describe your sort of life today? I know that horses are a big part of it. And
my life today?
And also, part B, I just have to put it out and then I'm going to stop talking, is just, you know, 50 years from now, how would you like people to look back and remember William Shatner?
Well, the last part first, what I want them to say 50 years from now is, I can't believe he's still alive.
Well, hey, sci-fi, sci-fi, it could be real.
Right, and those objections? Come on, man. Dr. Oz is a friend of mine.
Yeah, right. Make it happen.
Right.
Yeah.
What was the
first
part? Well,
and just, you know, about your life today, the things that make you happy.
Life today is, I am so filled with the joy of life, both athletically as well. I ride competitively on... three types of horses. I'm in the winning circle a lot. I have love all around me, and my family is here. I'm happily married. I'm gainfully employed. My mind is more creative now than it's ever been. I've got more projects, books, and comics, and watches, and motorcycles, and things that I'm working on. I've got documentaries. I did a ride from... Chicago to Los Angeles this summer on a bike and motorcycle I helped design. I
wow.
shot a documentary on it. I raised funds for the American Legion, their scholarship fund, and the whole idea was to sell motorcycles anyway. I helped design a watch, which got very popular and sold out. And I got a comic book, the likes of which have never been has never been seen before. It's called a graphic cinematic novel, in which the camera travels over the graphic novel with sound effects and music behind it, but you read the bubble.
Wow.
I got Leonard the book. I got another book, yeah. A great science fiction novel called Zero G. A great science fiction novel, Zero G, is coming out in October or November, and they've asked for a second novel, which we've written. Jeff Rovin, R-O-V-I-N,
yep.
Helped me write it.
Okay.
He's a wonderful writer. I've enjoyed working with him.
Right.
It's a barn burner, this right. science fiction novel. Leonard is getting rave reviews, the likes of which I can't imagine. And I'm going on tour next week for 2 weeks for 13 cities and may go for more in May, another 5 cities.
Not so
May,
retirement is not a word.
Retirement?
Not a
well, how do you spell that?
Well, I can't thank you enough for this. It's been great. And thank you for so many hours of great entertainment.
Thank
I appreciate
that.